We read this from cover to cover before we heard about the truth. And did we understand what it contained? I don't think we did. We understood some of the things that were in it because there's plain statements in the scriptures. But there was an awful lot that we didn't know a thing about, even though we had read it. And so we must have someone expound these things to us. And in the Lord's providence, we have had those set in the body all down through the age who would expound so that those who heard would understand and thus receive something to establish their faith upon. Well, some of the things that we have come to see when we have heard the word spoken concerns what the apostle says in the third chapter of Acts, the times of restitution. Now, some of you brethren may have different ideas. You may have seen different things first, but that was one of the first things that I saw and understood and was able to rejoice in was restitution. What does restitution mean? It simply means a restoring of something. If you lose $5 and somebody picks it up and asks you, did you lose this? And you say, yes, that's my $5. Well, then you have had your $5 restored to you, haven't you? Yes. And Adam lost his life, and so he's going to have it restored to him, and that's what we call restitution, isn't it? That's what the Apostle Peter called it anyway, when he said that times of refreshing shall come from the presence of the Lord, times of restitution of all things which God has spoken by the mouths of all his holy prophets since the world began. So that's one of the first things that we come to understand about is restitution and what a glorious sound that is. And then another thing that we come to understand or to know about is the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. The reason that God has set aside this gospel age for nearly 2,000 years now since Jesus died, we come to understand that he is picking out, he's selecting a little flock, just some of the members from the human race who are willing to accept the sacrifice of Christ and to follow faithfully in his footsteps of sacrifice, and that they, in reward, will, if faithful, be granted a nature and a body like Jesus has himself, which is a spiritual body. That is some of the things that are not seen by the natural eye. Well, now, we perhaps are able to gain a certain degree of understanding and appreciation of these two cardinal doctrines in the Bible from hearing about the Word of God. Now, friends, it is not necessary to have faith now in order to receive restitution in the kingdom. Now, we believe that there will always be a measure of faith exercised even during the kingdom, because they won't see God, they won't see spirit beings with a natural eye, and so, if you please, they will have to exercise that much faith to believe that there are spiritual beings. But nevertheless, they will actually receive God's blessings. They will not be looking forward to them in the future. And God sent his Son, Jesus, to die as a ransom sacrifice. He gave his life as a corresponding price for Adam. And he tasted death for every man. So that every man, every descendant of Adam, including Adam himself, is guaranteed by the fact of Jesus' death an awakening from the tomb in order to go up upon the highway of holiness and receive of God's blessings in the kingdom. It'll be up to the individual then whether he accepts those blessings or not. You know, it was an old proverb that the fathers have eaten a sour grape and the children's teeth are set on edge. But you know, the scriptures elsewhere say that it shall no longer be said the fathers have eaten a sour grape and their teeth and the children's teeth are set on edge, but he that eateth the sour grape, his teeth shall be set on edge. Now Father Adam ate the sour grape and our teeth are set on edge, but in the kingdom every man will be responsible for his own conduct. And so if any man chooses to disobey like Adam did, to sin, then he will bear the responsibility for his own sin. We are dying because Father Adam sinned, and that is, ate the sour grape of sin. So we say, it is not necessary to have faith now in order to receive the blessings of restitution in the kingdom. You will automatically receive them, but what you do with them will be up to the individual. So faith is the basis. What is faith the basis for now? If we don't need faith to come up in the kingdom, why worry about faith? Well, because faith is the basis for coming into relationship with God now in the gospel age, and by which we are convinced of those things that are not seen. Do you believe in God? You have never seen him, but if you have accepted what you have heard from here, then you believe that there is a God. Oh, you may say that I look out at the beautiful trees and the flowers, all the handiwork of nature, as David did. He, when I consider the heavens, he said, we perhaps might say, well, of course there must be a God. But some say, but oh, there's some kind of an intelligent creature, or intelligence at least, or some call it the God of nature. All these things are just arranged, period. But we believe that the scriptures indicate that all these things were arranged by an intelligent being, an intelligent creator, and that he has all these things under control, and that everything works according to certain fixed laws. Laws of nature, if you wish, but laws of God, nevertheless. So, we believe not only that God created these things, but we have come to see something about God's character. That he is a God of justice and wisdom and love and power. And that he is a personal God, not a principle. And we have come to understand something about his son Jesus. And that he was in his pre-human existence the Logos. That he came and at God's desire to give himself a ransom, a man, not part man, part God, not part spirit, part human, but he was a man, the man Christ Jesus, who gave his life a ransom for all. So then we come to know the truth of the matter of who Jesus was and what happened after his death, that he was highly exalted, being raised by God's almighty power, even to his own right hand, and has sat down at his side, and God is working all these things out through his beloved Son. And we have seen parts of his wonderful plan. Now here is presented before our minds a chart endeavoring to depict God's plan as it relates to the human race. It takes us from Adam's creation until Adam's restoration, 7,000 years in all. Well, do I need faith to believe that? Perhaps we might say that well, we can look in our history books. We know that the Jewish age was so long, approximately, according to history. We can look back and we can pretty well tell where Christ died. And we can look back and we can tell you all kinds of historical happenings during the gospel age. So do I need faith to say that that is the plan of God in the past? Yes, you still need faith, even though some of the history books may corroborate it. But ask anyone who has read history and who is an authority on history if they have had God's plan revealed to them through those episodes. Not one of them will even know anything about God's plan. So, even in the past, but particularly in the future, we have to have faith to see these things revealed to us. Yes, even God's plan is some of the things that are unseen. That is only believed and understood by the eye of faith. And then the hope of glory that we have already alluded to, the reward of those who will be like Jesus and share with him in the privilege of reigning in his kingdom. Yes, we need a measure of faith to understand these things. However, some of the things of God's Word are not so difficult that if we read the truth on the matter, say, for instance, you can take the first volume of Studies in the Scriptures, The Divine Plan of the Ages, and you can gain a very good understanding of God's plans and purposes. You may have a very good knowledge of these things, and you may even believe that they are true. But if that's all it is, then it is merely a belief. Unless that belief is acted upon. So we see that faith, even at this point, must be backed up by works, or it becomes dead. James continues his line of reasoning in the 26th verse. He says, "As the body without the breath is dead, so faith without works is dead also." You see, he is bringing before our mind something like the illustration that we use at times in regard to the creation of Adam. Now, Adam was made out of the dust of the earth. Now, when we say the dust of the earth, what we have in mind is the elements of which the earth is composed. You will find all these elements contained in the human body, so they tell us. So God took these elements, earthy. Man is of the earth, earthy. He formed a man. He formed the body. And there was the body, say we can just picture it in our minds, lying there in the Garden of Eden. It wasn't a man. It was just a corpse, actually. And then it says that God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. He caused breath to enter into that body and imparted to it the power to live. And so we breathe, don't we? And if we stop breathing, we die. So it says, God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Now, it doesn't say that God took a soul and put it into Adam. He breathed into his nostrils the breath of life and put a soul into him, and he was a human being. No, it says that man became a living soul, a sentient being. And so he sees, he hears, he smells, he tastes, he feels. He is a sentient being, a soul. So then we have the body, we have the breath, and we have a soul. Now the Apostle James maybe had this illustration in mind. At least it fits, where he says that the body without the breath is dead, so faith without works is dead also. So you may have faith just like the body, but if the body doesn't have breath, there is no soul, is there? It is dead. So faith must be coupled with works, or it is dead also. And thus faith must be animated by works. Faith must be acted upon. The Apostle Paul tells us in the 12th chapter of Romans, Brethren, I beseech you by the mercies of God that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. Now, whenever you present something, it suggests activity, doesn't it? It suggests a work. If I present somebody with that Bible, I am doing something. Or if I present them with a new Cadillac, I am doing something too. It doesn't matter what we present, it suggests activity and work. And a living sacrifice, as the Apostle Paul suggests, present your bodies a living sacrifice. If your sacrifice is living, then it requires a living faith, doesn't it? If you have a dead sacrifice, then you will have a dead faith, if I might put it that way. So then, in order to have a living sacrifice, we have a living faith, which means that we will be backing up our faith by our works. Sometimes, you know, we get tired of working, don't we? You know, the daily grind, as we call it, and we think that utopia or heaven would just be if we didn't have any work to do, we could just relax, maybe under a palm tree or a banana tree or something like that, and enjoy life. Just leisure. We think, at least we do sometimes when we feel tired and burdened with it all, we just like that kind of a life. Brethren, God didn't make his creatures to be lazy. And after all, if that would be our conception of utopia, I think we would soon get tired of it, or else we would get very lazy and not want to do anything at all. So God is not a God of idleness. Jesus said in John 5:17, "My Father works till now, and I work." I don't know anything about Einstein's theories, but I read that he had some theories regarding the universe. And other scientists are working on how the universe was made and how it's progressing and so on. And if you can believe their reports, they claim that the universe is expanding continually. It's going out at a speed so fast that we just can't even begin to think what they mean. Now, where it's going, they don't know, and how far it's going, they don't know, and where it came from, they don't know that either. But that just illustrates the fact that God is working. He is even now in the process of creating things in his universe. If we can just expand our minds to take in the vastness of God's domain, it helps us to get out of our littleness, confined to this little earthly ball as we are. However, don't misunderstand me to think that I agree with the Sputnik experts that it won't be too long before they're flying off to Mars and everywhere else in their rocket ships, because God made man to inhabit the earth, and that's where he's going to live. Not on Mars. I don't doubt someday that there may be somebody living on Mars when God gets ready to populate that planet, because it is a planet just like the earth. And God didn't create these planets capable of sustaining life just for fun. He created this earth not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. And if he created Mars to be inhabited, it will be someday. But not by people that live on Earth, because there's different conditions out there. It's a different distance from the sun. It has a different atmosphere and all the rest of those things. So whatever being it will be a being capable of living happily and forever upon that planet. Now, why would people want to move from the Earth to Mars if it was entirely unsuited to them? I don't think they will. Well, anyway, that's a little bit off the subject, isn't it? So, no, God is working. Yes, Jesus worked. And so we want to be working too. And the thing that we have to work at right now is in God's service. So in maybe we could just take a minute to think about a couple of God's faithful servants of past ages. Think of Noah, for instance. Noah was a worker. He must have been, or he couldn't have built that ark, could he? So God told Noah that there was going to be a flood on the earth, and that he wanted him to build a boat large enough to hold himself and his family and all these various animals. Now, Noah believed God. He believed that there would be a flood on the earth. He had faith that there would be. Well, suppose Noah had said, "Well, Lord, I believe what you say, but, well, it's a lot of work to build a big boat like that, and I've never seen one built. I have no blueprints, and I've never seen a boat. What's it for?" "Well, I've never seen a boat on water. I think I'll just sort of take a wait-and-see policy." "I believe so, but God will look after us somehow." When the flood of waters came, I'm afraid that Noah would have been drowned with everybody else. But Noah not only believed God and had faith in what he said, but he acted upon that faith, and he worked until the boat was completed, and not a minute too soon. The Lord ushered them into the ark and shut the door. And then think of Abraham. God said to Abraham, "Get out of thy country into a land that thou knowest not, neither thou nor thy fathers, into a land that I will show thee." Well, did Abraham argue with God? No, he went. He was obedient. He believed that God could do what he said. But the supreme test of Abraham's life, he tried to have an heir in Eliezer, his servant. That wasn't God's arrangement. He borrowed his wife's handmaid and had a son when he realized that his heir would be of his own loins. But that wasn't God's arrangement. He didn't accept Ishmael as Abraham's son and the seed to bless all the families of the earth. Now, Abraham waited year in and year out, still no seed. And finally, in God's time, Isaac was born. And he grew up, and he probably was the apple of Abraham's eye. And then God said, "Take your son Isaac, take the wood, take the fire, take him up upon the mount, 3 days' journey, and sacrifice him upon that altar." What was the implications? It was to Abraham, if he slew his son, that the only hope that he would have for him would be that Isaac would come forth in the future resurrection in which he believed. Yes, Abraham believed in the resurrection. That was the only hope he had. Did he say to God, "Oh, I can't do that. Look at all the trouble we've gone to, and we finally got this son, the seed, and heir. Now you want me to kill him? Oh, I believe that you could restore him in the resurrection, but that's just asking too much. I can't do that." Would Abraham have been called the father of the faithful in such a case? No, his past belief in God would not have sustained him then. But Abraham believed God, and he was willing to carry it out by works and actually slay his son. But God was only making a picture. And so he provided a ram caught in the thicket and told Abraham to slay the ram. And what did that all picture? See, God didn't want human sacrifice like that. The psalmist said that no man can give a ransom for his brother, so what good would it have done for Isaac to have been slain? None at all. But Abraham received him in a figure, as it were. Figuratively, he right there and then he received Isaac in the resurrection. That showed that God was going to give the dearest treasure of his heart, his only begotten Son Jesus, not in a figure. No, he literally gave his Son a ransom sacrifice, and Jesus actually did go down into death in order that we might have life. So then, all of God's people of the past backed up their faith by their works. Let us look at a couple of parables. Matthew 20, the parable of the vineyard. And you remember the master of the vineyard went out, and he saw the men standing in the market, and he bid them come and work in his vineyard. And he said, I'll agree if you come to work in my vineyard for a penny a day. Well, that's fine. They agreed to work for a penny. Oh, long little later, was it about the sixth hour, wasn't it? He went back, and there was some more standing there idle. What are you doing here? Well, I have no work. Go into the vineyard and work, he said. Labor. So they went. And about the ninth hour, went out, there was somebody else standing there. Why are you standing here idle? Oh, nobody's hired us. Well, you go into the vineyard and work too. So they did. About the 11th hour, the master came. Why, there's still more standing there in the marketplace. Why stand you here all the day? Well, no man has hired us, they said. And so he says, go ye also into the vineyard and labor. And they did. And so when it came to the end of the day, he called the laborers to give them their hire. And he paid them all a penny. Is there any work to do now, friends? Aren't we too far along the stream of time? Hasn't it all been done? Hasn't the gospel age work finished? We believe this parable points out that this time we're living in, the harvest of the gospel age, is the 11th hour. Yes, that's right. He says, go ye also into the vineyard and labor. The harvest hasn't ended. The 11th hour is still here. The blessings of the kingdom haven't started. Go ye also into the vineyard. What for? Brother Charlie said, just to bask in the shade of the vines? No, we go into the vineyard to work, to do something. The call still is, go ye also into the vineyard and labor. Now the 25th chapter of Matthew brings to our attention a parable about the talents. You remember he gave them out to his servants. Some had 10, some 5, and some 1. Or just bring it down to 1 each. The one with 10, he went out and he used it and accumulated more. The one with 5 did the same. They were rewarded with when the master returned. But the one that only had 1 talent, he hid it. When the Lord came, he fearfully presented it to him and said, There it is. I haven't lost it. Still just as good as it ever was. The master, what did he say? Was he pleased? He was angry, wasn't he? And he told him that even the talent that he had, he would lose. Well, why was that? Why would he lose it? He hadn't done anything wrong with it. But that's just the trouble, isn't it? He didn't do anything with it. And so the Lord is showing us that if we have a talent, whatever it is, we believe these talents represent the talents that we have, whether it be of speaking or writing or wealth or position, whatever it may be that we have as a talent, an ability to serve the Lord, coupled with the opportunities to use that talent. If we don't use it, then we will lose it. Some may think they don't have any talents, but brethren, the very humblest of the Lord's people have something that they can use in his service or he would never have called you into that service. Maybe it's just writing a letter. If you can write a letter, and you know somebody that's shut in or isolated or something, and you can cheer them up a little bit by telling them a little bit about the truth in a letter, a nice friendly little letter, that's a talent that we can use. Or sending out a kingdom card, sending out one of those hope cards, dropping a tract at a front door. These may not sound like big things, but they're a talent if we can use it. So then, we are to be faithful in using what the Lord has given us to do. Again, faith backed up by works. And then again, the other part of that, in Luke 19, about the brethren with the pound. Now, we think that this pound represents our justification, the common ground that we all have, the pound that we all possess, having on the robe of Christ's righteousness. The same thing happened. Some used their pound, some didn't. And the one that had the pound and didn't use it illustrates those who don't do anything with their justification. They don't do anything with their standing in Christ Jesus, and we must do something with that, or it will not be of avail to bring us into the hope of glory, to be with Jesus, to be like him, to see him as he is in his kingdom. In 2 Corinthians 6:1, the Diaglot, and being also co-laborers, we exhort you not to receive the favor of God in vain. In the common version, it says, we exhort you as workers together with God. The Diaglot says co-laborers. We are laboring together in this vineyard. Now, if we receive a favor from God, if we don't appreciate it or make use of it, whatever that favor, to that extent we have received it in vain. But this particular point means this that we have just pointed out, this justification, this standing in Christ by which we come into relationship with God now during the gospel age as sons of God with a new hope set before us. If we fall away, then we have received this favor in vain. It was a favor of God to bring us up as his sons. And we want to labor diligently that we may make our calling and election sure and not receive that favor of God in vain. In Philippians 2:12, the apostle says, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. We have a lot of work to do in order to work out our own salvation. It's not easy. But brethren, we realize that it isn't just that we are trying to accomplish a work, but that it is that God is working in us. He is accomplishing something in us. And we are to will. We desire to do God's will, yes, but not only to desire, but to do it. We have faith and we have works. 2 Peter 1:5 says, add to your faith. The Diaglot says, super add. In other words, you have your foundation again. You have your bases. Now when they built the new post office downtown, they started with the top floor, and then they worked down and left it hanging there. Well, that would be a very peculiar way to build a building, wouldn't it, on the earth? No, they had to lay a foundation first, and if you saw it, I saw a little bit of it, they had a great, huge hole in there that would swallow up an awful lot of smaller buildings, and they had to put a tremendous foundation in there to hold up that great huge building. And so, brethren, we must have a faith as the foundation to build the superstructure of a Christian character. And then in the 10th verse he says, give diligence to make your calling and election sure, for if you believe these things, that's all you have to do. No, he didn't say that, did he? He says, if you do these things, you shall never fall. If you add to your faith all these virtues that he's talked about, practice them, then you indeed shall never fall. So, we could say that some of the things that we, or one of the things that we can work on is ourselves. And I think you'll agree with me that working on ourselves is a pretty big job. It's a lifetime job, and we will never actually perfectly complete it. But God takes the intentions as instead of the act in this gospel age. There are some who would like to say that working on self is the only thing that is necessary at the present time. But to that, I do not think the scriptures agree. While we can't minimize the importance of working on self and putting on these fruits and graces of the Spirit, and yes, helping one another to do this, to build one another up in the most holy faith, nevertheless, those who use this line of reasoning say so as distinct from the idea of going out and witnessing to others about the truth. In thinking about it, I don't think there's any finer way to grow in grace and knowledge than by the simple method of preaching the gospel to others. In fact, Jesus commissioned his followers to go out and preach the gospel of the kingdom. That is the good news of the kingdom. The way it appeals to me, if we just have our little select circle, it is somewhat like the monks did in the Dark Ages, and still do perhaps. They seclude themselves, they isolate themselves from the world, thinking that thus they can live a more holy, a more pious life, and put on these fruits and graces more easily. But you know, brethren, the Lord doesn't want us to put the graces on that way. He wants us to be tried on the battlefield of life and to gain experience in life in order to accomplish this. I might use an illustration of the company I work for uses this in their advertising. Now, they try to point out that you should get a tire to fit the job. And they have a picture of a man with a fencing sword. Now, which would he use in making a fencing sword? The material that's in that sword? Or would he take a coat hanger and use that to make a fencing sword? And it shows him stretching the coat hanger. Well, it's just like a piece of lead. It just has no particular shape. You can bend it any way you like. And if you tried to poke it into something, it would just bend and crumple up. So you've got to use the right material for the right job. And so you would use finely tempered high-grade steel for a fencing sword. And that's what the Lord is doing with his people in the gospel age. He isn't molding them out of putty. He's tempering them in the crucible of the fiery experiences of life. If you try to put on the fruits of patience, is the best way to do, to have no contact with anybody or anything, so that nothing will ever ruffle you or disturb you? I think that some of us can say that we may have thought we had some patience at one time. And in my particular case, there was a little boy that came along that showed me that I didn't have, really no patience at all. And I'm still struggling with it too. You see, God, if we pray for patience, He gives us some trials to test our patience. Yes, that's right. If we have a fiery temper, are we going to seclude ourselves so that nobody will ever ruffle us or bother us, so that our temper will be raised? We're going to be given experiences that is going to just make us burn up and boil and everything to make us control our temper. Isn't that right? Yes, God is testing us and trying us in the battlefield of life. Something else that we can do is to labor in the vineyard. This is a text that I think probably you will remember Brother Horace Wright used to quote a lot in Ecclesiastes 11:6. In the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thine hand. For thou knowest not whether shall prosper either this or that, or whether they both alike shall be good. You don't know, really. You may sow your seed literally in the morning, or you may sow it in the evening, or in the middle of the day. Or it may be that it's sowed in the beginning of the gospel age, and at the end of the gospel age, and in the middle too. Or it may be, as we are now in the transition period, the present evil world is going down into destruction, and the millennial age is coming up, its power being visible in the destruction of the present systems. There is a reaping work going on, and there is a sowing work going on. Some of that sowing may be sowing millennial age seed. It's the same seed of truth that's doing it. We're not trying to sow millennial age seed. All we're doing is sowing the seed of truth. And the Lord giveth the increase. I was reading in the Reader's Digest about seeds one time, quite a while ago, must be about a year and a half ago now. And you know, a desert is a barren place, but once in a while they claim that a terrific shower will come across a certain portion of the desert. And almost overnight, it'll be carpeted in green grass. And sometimes there'll be some little flowers that they're so small and insignificant that you can hardly see them. But they say that they will almost literally come from a seed, grow up, bud, and blossom into a beautiful little flower, and fade and die away overnight, practically. Yes, they say such little seeds as that will lie in the desert sands for from 2 to 5 years, some of them are known to do, dormant. No life there at all. Visible, that is. And then along comes that little shower, and it'll spring forth. Now that, to me, was quite amazing. But it was in the Digest, and apparently it's authentic and authoritative. To me, that illustrates a point. It shows that a seed of truth may be sown. It may not bear fruit today. It may not bear fruit next week or next month or next year. But nevertheless, sow thy seed and cast thy bread upon the waters, and after many days it shall return unto you. I could give an illustration in my own mother's case. She lived in Kamloops about during the First World War. And there was a lady who tried to give her a book to read. And she put it off on the excuse that my older brother, who was then just a little fella, might tear the book, and because she was very particular that it shouldn't be spoiled or destroyed in any way. Well, the circumstances during the First World War, of course, you know, were rather difficult for Bible students. But nevertheless, we'll say that was around 1918. Well, about 20 years later, another lady left a seed of truth in a similar manner, and it was accepted. And at that time, my mother looked back, and she could see that that was what she almost got 20 years before that from this lady in Kamloops. But Lord's providence, she wasn't ready for it then. But also in the Lord's providence, that seed, while it may have lain dormant all these years, a little sprinkle of the water of truth was able to let it forth so that it could grow. You pardon me for giving a personal illustration, but I think that that illustrates the point of these little seeds of truth that may be sown, and they may bring forth fruitage years later. And if it doesn't bring forth fruitage in the gospel age, brethren, I'm sure that it will bring forth fruit in the millennial age. Jesus said, I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day, for the night cometh when no man can work. That'll be the time when there'll be no question about it, whether or not we should work and labor. We won't be able to labor. But let's not be of those who themselves set the time and say, there's no more work to do, don't do anything. Let us be of those who say, it's the Lord's hand. We can't labor now, even if we want to, because the Lord has closed it down. Let's let the Lord stop the work in the vineyard, not us. We received some very helpful instructions and help in this little manna book. The children of Israel ate manna, and it was a picture of heavenly manna. And so the phrase has been coined, as it were, to represent in this little book some of the texts and comments by Brother Russell that have been given to us to help us day by day. And I think we can all say, those who have read these comments daily, that they are a help in our daily life. It is a little lift to us each morning. In the May the 2nd manna, I'd like to read this comment to you. To be really in the Lord's service involves first the careful and continual study of God's plan. Second, the imbibing of its spirit, leading, thirdly, to an enthusiastic zeal for its accomplishment and to activity to the extent of ability in its service at whatever cost or sacrifice it may require. In April the 30th manna, there is a comment regarding telling the truth to others. Like the hymn says, you know, tell it out among the nations. And as the prophet Ezekiel said, he was weary with forbearing, and he couldn't forbear. It was in his bones as a fire, and he couldn't refrain from telling out the message that he had. So that's the way it should be with us. And this comment says, am I going forth daily to my neighbors near and far? Well, who is my neighbor? Is it the person who lives next door to me? Yes, that's my neighbor. I can tell him about the beauty of God's plans and about his kingdom. Is it my neighbor down the street there? He's a couple of blocks away. Oh, yes, that's my neighbor too. I can tell him about the kingdom. Well, how about my neighbor over on the other side of town? That's still my neighbor. Am I telling my neighbors near and far these blessed tidings? Well, I don't know. That fellow over there, I don't think that he would like the truth. I don't think he's interested in the Bible or religion or anything. Not much point saying anything to him. I had a little experience like that once. I was taking the first volumes around, and a lady in this house agreed to borrow one for a couple of weeks and read it. And it was a kind of a dead-end street up in the valley there, you know. They don't have paved streets like they do here, and there was a lot of bush around, and there was a little house along there, and I said, "Does anybody live down there?" "Oh, yes, a lady lives there, but I don't think it'd do you any good to go there. You're just wasting your time." Well, being a bit stubborn, you know, I thanked her very much, and I hiked on down the road. I knocked on the door, and a very pleasant lady came, and I told her what I was there for. I told her about this little book that told her about the kingdom and helped us to understand the Bible. Why, she was very interested and took one off me right there and then. I wouldn't have been able to leave that there if I had accepted this other lady's advice. Now, it's the last I ever heard of her, so maybe she didn't get anything out of it anyway. But nevertheless, it just illustrates the point that we should take it forth, whether we think anyone is receptive. If the time is opportune, let it be in season to us to sow a seed of truth. Thank God that it isn't up to us to determine who should and who shouldn't be witness to concerning the kingdom. It is God that is doing the drawing and the choosing. All we're doing is sowing the seed of truth, and God waters it and giveth the increase. In Hebrews 12:11, "No chastening for the moment seemeth to be joyous." That's right. Sometimes the truth brings its trials and difficulties. And sometimes we are chastened of the Lord for some of our missteps. "No chastening for the moment seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness to them that are exercised thereby." This is from the Greek word gymnazo. And you know what a gymnasium is for? Exercising your muscles. So, brethren, let's try to be rightly exercised by the experiences of life, because by this means, God is preparing you for a place in the kingdom. In Hebrews 10:22-23, we have a wonderful assurance. "Let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith." Not just partly, but full assurance of faith. "Let us hold fast the profession of our faith, for he is faithful that promised." Now I'd like to read to you another little text that has been very helpful to me in the past year. It's found on June 5th. It's based on a comment by the psalmist in the 31st Psalm and the first verse. "In thee, O Lord, do I put my trust." Now, some of you know I have emphasized this quite a bit, but it truly has been a wonderful help to me in considering these things and realizing with whom I have to do, and that he is able to make us conquerors. There is nothing that puts the Christian at greater disadvantage in the presence of his foes than for him to let go, even temporarily, his grip upon the anchor of faith. Let him do so for a moment, and of necessity darkness begins to gather round him, and he cannot see the brightness of his Father's face, for without faith it is impossible to please God. And while he grapples again for the anchor, the powers of darkness fiercely assail him with doubts and fears. And this is the part that appealed to me. Based generally upon his human imperfections. Doesn't it make you discouraged sometimes when you realize just how poor and weak and needy you are? To realize how little we can do at the best of times, and we feel that we're just absolutely useless. But brethren, that's all very well to keep us humble and meek and submissive in the Lord's providence, but it can go too far, and we can become despondent and then we can't serve the Lord properly. So then, let us not be discouraged, but remember this, that Satan tries to make us feel that way, appealing to our failings, our human imperfections, which he should ever bear in mind are covered by the robe of Christ's righteousness. If we would have the peace of God reign in our hearts, we must never let go our anchor, nor suffer Satan's deadliest strife to beat our courage down. The language of our hearts should always be, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Revelation 14:13, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, they rest from their labors, but their works do follow after them. So, friends, is it going to be a question of entering into heavenly bliss and playing harps and resting upon a fluffy cloud? Not at all. We'll be working together with God in all his kingdom interests. But the laborious, the tedious part of it will be gone. In John 14:12, he that believeth on me, the works that I do shall he do, and greater works than these shall he do. How could we do greater works than Jesus did by raising the dead and healing the sick and opening the blind eyes? Because in the kingdom, it will be on such a vast scale, it will be worldwide, and Adam and all his children will all be affected by these greater works. And we shall not only give them a little longer life like Lazarus had to go back into the tomb, but we will give them everlasting life if they will accept it. They will receive actual blessings in the kingdom and go on to receive of life and God's blessing forevermore. So may God add his blessing. Shall we close by singing number 273?